What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Kim is a mother and nurse from Indiana. She reached out to the Broken Cycle Media team in hopes of sharing her story for the first time, to bring awareness to a trajectory she never thought she would have had to traverse. Nearly a decade into her marriage, her whole life changed with a home raid by the FBI and several other criminal justice forces. The organizations would consequently find a large catalog of child sexual abuse material in her then-husband's possession. However, at the start, Kim wasn't aware of all the facets of his crime, and it would take her years to learn everything, as well as to receive what closure the legal system offered. We are so grateful that Kim was willing to highlight all that continues to come next for her and her children, and that she's sharing her immense fortitude and strength with our audience today.
My name is Kim, and my most important job is as a mom. I have two kids. My son is 20 and my daughter is 17. My loved ones, I think, would describe me as a caregiver. I am also a nurse, so I tend to be the one that wants to jump in and fix. I initially went into working in the NICU and then also pediatrics, but I ended up falling in love with palliative care and hospice. I began trying to build a program that would serve newborns that needed that care. I love that holistic care and that it's interdisciplinary. I was raised in Indianapolis. I had a wonderful upbringing, a phenomenal family. My parents had pretty traditional values, and family was the most important thing. I started with three brothers, two older and one younger. And then we kind of brought a fourth brother into the fold, who's my brother from another mother. So growing up, I had four crazy boys that taught me to be tough, but we were very close as a family. So when push really came to shove, we always came together and supported each other. I think being the only girl in the family, they always complained that I got special privileges. I did feel kind of special in that respect. They certainly could be protective at times. I liked that. As I got older, I went to them for advice. They picked on me and they definitely taught me to be tough, but they were there for me as we got much older. Looking back, I think expectations, generally speaking, were really high. There certainly was an expectation that we go on to college, probably find someone and get married, and that we would be married for the rest of our lives. I went to some really fantastic schools, was really blessed to be able to go to private school. I loved to play basketball. I was a little bit sporty. Anything that involved my group of friends or going out and being social was all my thing. Before college, I thought that I wanted to be a doctor. Then I hit this wall with math and thought, well, maybe this will not end up being my thing. So I started looking at nursing. And the more that I learned as I was seeking my bachelor's in nursing, I loved it more and more. College was amazing. It was exciting. I felt like I was finally adulting, but you kind of have that safety net underneath you still. Wyatt was a leader in my orientation group. So I met him the first week of school, my freshman year. I joined a sorority. I was really involved in Greek life all 4 years. My sorority happened to be pretty close with my brother's fraternity. I think I saw Wyatt more as a connection to my brother being in the same fraternity than anything else. Initially, he was just an acquaintance. He was fun to hang out with. We would run into each other at parties or at his fraternity functions. And then it just kind of grew from there. When he initially asked me out, I remember calling my older brother and asking him, "What do you think of this guy? Do you think I should date him?" He actually said, "He can maybe be a little dorky sometimes, but he's safe." We dated ultimately for 4.5 years. He was one of my very best friends all through college. We never argued. We were very gentle with each other. I remember one incident in college. We were at a party and he was upset about something and he yelled really loudly. His voice sounded scary. I remember telling him that, and then I didn't ever want to hear him yell like that. I never heard him yell after I asked for that. So there seemed to be decent respect and friendship. We seemed to work well together, but I also had a lot of other friends. I had a big social circle. It was never an issue, me spending time with friends, even with his fraternity brothers, or doing activities with the whole group was never a problem. Jealousy was never an issue. I felt kind of free to have my own life while within this relationship. It wasn't always fireworks and excitement. I think at points it was maybe even bordering on kind of boring, but it was stable, and I guess it felt safe. As I look back, it's so strange because I felt like I did everything that I could do or that I knew to do to try to mitigate risks. I felt like I really knew this person. I felt like I was taking well thought out, intentional steps to do the right things or do them in the right order so that we had the best chance of having a good, successful marriage and family and that we would be happy and healthy. When I graduated, I had my bachelor's in science of nursing, a BSN. Then after that, I just had to take my boards. Actually, all within that 1 year, I graduated from college. I bought a house. I got married. I took my boards, began my first real professional nursing job, and had a baby. At the time, I thought it was great. In hindsight, it was a lot. But I was excited about the prospect of our life, our future, our family. Everything felt like it was fitting into place perfectly. I felt really blessed. I always wanted to be a mom. Even more than being a nurse, that was the ultimate job that I wanted, was to be a mom. We didn't expect our son quite so fast. My son was born in 2004. And then I think our first wedding anniversary was a few weeks after he was born, but it was wonderful. Wyatt had never had any experience with kids. He was the oldest, has just one younger brother. He didn't have a lot of extended family, at least not here in the United States, since his parents had come here as adults from Germany. So it was very apparent when my son was born that this was absolutely the first time he was holding a baby, the first time he was changing a diaper. I remember one incident when my son was a newborn and he started crying. Wyatt went and picked him up. I had just had a C-section, so I couldn't get out of bed very quickly. And he just sat on the bed, stone cold still, holding this screaming baby. And I remember saying, "You've got to rock or bounce or walk or something." I think there was definitely an assumption that that would be more so my role, taking care of the house, taking care of the kids. But he really did jump in and help. I would have liked to be at home with them more than working after my son was born, and certainly than my daughter. We couldn't quite make the ends meet if either one of us stayed home with them. and backed off of work. So we were about 50-50 as far as bringing in income for the household. I worked 12 and a half hour shifts. I worked a lot of weekends for a period of time. I worked nights. So he really had to step up to the plate and have 12, 13 hours maybe on a Saturday where he's dad and it's just him and the kids. He did, I think, step up into that role as he learned and for all intents and purposes appeared to be a really wonderful dad. We actually moved from Michigan, where we had gone to college, back to Indianapolis to be closer to my family because we wanted to have another baby. My daughter was born in 2008. So we had a boy and a girl and they were perfect. It was a really great experience when I had my daughter. Having already had one, it was a little more exciting and there was a little less anxiety the second time around. And everything appeared to be thriving. This was the family that I always wanted. It almost seemed surreal at that time. March 31st, 2011. The night before, we had gone to bed with our daughter sleeping in bed next to me. We woke up just before dawn and we heard this incredibly loud banging. It felt like it shook the house or like someone was trying to break the door down. He and I jumped out of bed and when we opened the door, there were all of these FBI agents in their big bulletproof vests and they had guns drawn. My initial thought was, is there some criminal on the loose? Do they think someone is in our yard or in our house? It did not cross my mind that they were there for us. It very quickly sunk in that they were pointing the guns at us. I remember putting my hands up. They pulled us out into the yard on the front lawn and had us kind of separated on different sides of the yard. And I kept trying to tell them that my kids were inside. I could see through the front door. I could see them going up the stairs. I was just terrified for my children. We knew we were going to wake up to these strange people with guns and I wouldn't be there. That was my biggest concern. They gave no information about why they were there. I remember just a sea of law enforcement of all kinds and cars parked in the yard. They had a mobile forensics unit parked in the front yard so that they could process evidence there and look at electronics immediately. It was just a swarm. The number of agencies that were involved was huge. There were special agents of the FBI and then officers from the Kokomo Police Department, Indiana State Police, Indianapolis Metropolitan Police, Brownsburg Police Department, Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, and the FBI's Cybercrime Task Force were all involved that day. It was very confusing. It feels like you're walking through quicksand in a thick cloud. Everything seemed disorienting. But they immediately separated me from my husband. They took me upstairs. We were in my daughter's bedroom. There were two to three agents, sometimes one or two of them would come and go. It was hours of interrogation. Meanwhile, they had my husband downstairs somewhere else in the house. I assume interrogating him as well. I did not know for quite a while what was going on with my children. That was something that they kind of masterfully used to make sure that I was being honest and talking. They at one point said, well, tell us about this, this, and this, and then we will give you an update on the kids. I felt completely helpless to help them. I was really angry that it happened that way. They did tell me they were there because of child pornography. That was how they phrased it. I immediately started to cry and I said, are my kids okay? I didn't know, are they here because something happened to my kids that I didn't know about? They said they did not recognize my children. They were not children that they had been seeing, for example, on the internet. I didn't quite have all the pieces. I would never have guessed that that they were there for my husband. They started out by asking simple questions. Is the internet bill in my name? Yes, it is. Things like that. They wanted to find flash drives. They wanted to find the specific things they were looking for, some of which I had never seen. And at one point said, we'll break through the walls to find what we need to find. So either you tell us where it is, or we're going to start tearing down the house to get it. It's a really strange feeling to have all of these strangers going through literally everything, even things that are intimate. They have photographed my entire underwear drawer. It just feels very invasive. When they told me my husband wasn't cooperating with them, my heart just sank. It didn't make sense to me. Why would he not cooperate? So I remember that being a very devastating feeling. I also remember well that they had really large pictures, probably 8x10, that they ultimately asked me to look at because they were trying to find children that they believe were actively being abused. So they wanted me to look at the photographs and tell them if I recognized anything. Do you recognize a mole on this person? Or do you recognize the wallpaper, a pillowcase, or the blinds? Some of those pictures, one in particular, I can never unsee it. It felt like it took a long time, but I did finally get to see my kids. They let me go back downstairs. People are walking everywhere. The front door is wide open, and it's March in Indiana, so it's cold. I remember seeing my daughter standing in the family room, and she had just worn an oversized t-shirt and a pull-up to bed. It looked like she was shivering, and I went and I scooped her up. I said, oh, honey, are you cold? And she said, no, mommy, look, all the bad men. And that crushed me. I said, no, sweetie, they're here to keep us safe. But it hurt my heart that she was scared to the point that she was shivering and shaking. And it was important to me that my kids didn't have a bad view of law enforcement or of the justice system. I had an amazing friend who saw the commotion. We live on a main street and it had been rush hour morning traffic. So we're kind of right there for everyone to see. I guess she came and demanded that she see that I was okay and the kids were okay. And they did let me see her briefly. I don't think we even said anything to each other. I just cried and hugged her. She said, can I take the kids? And I said, yes, please. So thankfully, the kids were able to leave that situation a little bit early. And it was a huge, huge blessing. Ultimately, they put him in handcuffs. They arrested him that day and took him with them. I didn't have a lot of detailed information about exactly what his charges were, what they did or didn't find. They didn't share any of that with me. They gave me a card for the victim's advocate. And then once they had walked out, I saw on my kitchen counter his wallet and his wedding ring. Every other room in the house had piles of these brown paper bags that they had put stickers on, said FBI evidence of things that they had looked at and ultimately not kept. So everything was just kind of a mess, but suddenly very quiet. And the first person I called was my little brother, my younger brother. He is my rescuer. He was wonderful. He said, we're going to have to call mom and dad, and that we needed to call Wyatt's parents, that we needed to let the family know what was happening. He immediately came over and he picked me up. He just kind of carried me through, told me what I needed to do next or where we were going. I don't think I could have done that on my own. The details of the rest of that day get very fuzzy. I remember some bits and pieces. He did have a short hearing. I took some notes, but I don't even really remember it. And that was when they discussed his charges. Initially, he was charged with 9 counts. The first was exploitation of a child. Charges 2 through 9 were possession and or distribution of child pornography. They were all felonies. They were all federal counts. I wanted so badly to believe this really had been inadvertent or accidental, which was how he portrayed it to me. He said that he was not sexually attracted to children, that he had not sought this out. I made it very clear that even if I didn't have all of the facts of the investigation, they were not accessible to me in that moment, that I would get them at some point and I would know the truth. I made it very clear that I would protect my children, even if that meant I had to protect them from their father. I'd never had any experience on that side of the law. So I expected that he would post bail, he would come out. No, they said they were not going to release him. I remember them saying they didn't feel I could control him at home. He remained at a halfway house that's locked called VOA or Volunteers of America. Volunteers of America happened to be set up such that they could hold both state and federal inmates. So they had people that were on pretrial like he was. They also had people that had been released from jail or prison after a long sentence. It was kind of a launching pad as they try to reintegrate into society. There was so much about the legal system that I was going to learn about, whether I wanted to or not. Things felt very disconnected for those months. They were really tough. They were really disorienting and just scary. All of the ground underneath you feels shaky. I didn't know what to think. If you've ever heard someone use the term thinking outside the box, I felt like I didn't even have a box. There was no frame of reference anymore for what was happening or what our lives were. I drove a lot because I could put the kids in their car seats and turn on some music. Early on, I didn't process new information really well. I used to be an avid reader. I couldn't read. I couldn't pay attention to a television show or shows that I really used to enjoy. I couldn't watch anymore. It was just a very strange time as information came out later. There were a lot of little things that I missed that I think I just didn't take in. It's fascinating how the mind works in those situations when you're in that crisis mode. It runs its own little autopilot. Even when he was able to make a phone call, I knew there was no real honest conversation. There was no opportunity during those months because every call was recorded and anything you say can be used against you. I knew that I wasn't going to get a genuine, honest answer. It was just very generalized. Like he would say, it's not what it seems. There were no specifics that were shared on those calls. But I really wasn't given much of any information at that time from the district attorney or anyone on that side. I was kind of in a prime position looking back at it now for him to manipulate the information that I did get or didn't get. His lawyers made it very clear to me that they were his lawyers, not mine. So he certainly did have the ability to say, you can tell my wife this, but you can't tell her that. And they had to honor that. What was going on with the kids at that time too was really difficult. Their whole world had been rocked. My son became very angry. He was six. He, for the first time, started to become pretty mean towards his sister. She had just turned three a few days before his arrest, but she was showing signs of trauma and had regressed in a lot of ways. So I knew that we needed help. I felt pretty helpless as a mom. I felt like I wasn't able to give them all of me. I wasn't fully there the way I wanted to be for them. I couldn't stop crying. I'm sure that they could sense my anxiety and distress just in the household. When I tried to reach out to some therapists and see if I could get counseling started for them, a lot of people turned us down because my daughter was under five. They all agreed, yes, it sounds like she's been pretty traumatized, but that they didn't see patients under five. I remember that being a big challenge and frustrating. It was hard to find support for the kids. Eventually, we finally found a play therapist who started working with us, and that made a tremendous difference. She also did work with me and the kids later when he was released with an ankle monitor. She also was able to meet with all four of us together and with him and the kids. After a few months where he was detained, they did kind of suddenly decide they were going to release him back to home with an ankle monitor and supervision. At this point, I still didn't have all of the information. I had a lot of questions. We were finally going to have a little bit of opportunity to talk. He's still on pretrial. I still didn't trust that what I was being told was completely the truth. And I think he was just scrambling to try and save the pieces of his life that were falling apart. I didn't know what to believe. So I had backed away from work, had taken some time off so that I could be there. I tried to make sure that either I was there with the kids or there was someone else in extended family that was able to be at home when the kids were there so that he was not caring for them alone or bathing them, helping them get dressed. So he was there, but those roles had shifted a bit. Initially, I wasn't thinking of divorce. I think it was a word that wasn't really in my vocabulary at the time. I had never imagined that or pictured that for us. Initially, it was, how do we work through this as a family? What does this mean for our family? I did eventually find out that he was going to have to serve at least 5 years, which to me at the time was a huge flag. I didn't understand why, if this was something that was not intentional. I felt like there was certainly more to it than I knew. But I think deep down, I really felt like we were going to find out this was something that had happened inadvertently, that was a mistake, that was an error, which doesn't make much sense hearing myself say it now. I think I just wanted that to be true so badly that if there was a glimmer of hope that that was the case, that I was going to cling to it. During that pretrial period, after he was released to come home on the ankle monitor, my focus really became the kids and preparing them for what was to come. We told them the truth in the most age-appropriate way that we could. We were very honest about the fact that Dad had broken the law. We wanted them to understand that there was a process for how we handle this when there's an adult that breaks the rules. It was our hope that they didn't feel like the system came in and stole their parent and wrecked their family. I took my son to the courtroom before sentencing. So it was an empty courtroom. Here's where the judge sits, and here's where your dad will sit with his lawyer. Here's where the prosecution will be. And that was helpful for him. We didn't allow the children to be in the courtroom at sentencing. He did ultimately take a plea deal. It was approximately a year after his arrest that we ultimately had the sentencing, which they scheduled to be on my birthday. It was a tough day. Everyone on the extended family on both sides came to the sentencing. I actually had some really, really wonderful people that I worked with. Many of them came to support me. They sat with me and they held my hands, and they were amazing. They just went above and beyond to be there for me. They called up one of the federal agents who had been kind of primary on the investigation before his arrest and had played a big role during the raid. When he went up to speak in great detail about the raid on my home, my anxiety had gotten so high at that point. That was as much as I could take. I actually quietly slipped out the back door, and I just needed a minute to gather myself. So there were parts of the sentencing hearing that I did not hear. Everyone in the family was asked by his defense team to write a letter on his behalf, asking for leniency or speaking to his character or our experiences of him. I intended to, up until the last minute, and I just couldn't. There weren't words that I could put on that paper. the judge said something that really struck me. And now that I know more, it holds a bit of a different meaning. But at one point, the judge said, "You may have appeared to be a very good father, but you were a terrible husband." I was kind of upset that the judge said that. And I realize now the information that she had in front of her that even I did not know. Something else that stood out to me that I learned around the time of sentencing, there was an upward departure. So meaning they add points onto how they factor what your sentence will be. There were points added for the number of images or videos that he had. And there was also an upward departure because there were images that depicted violence or bondage. That was just two little pieces that did not quite fit into the narrative and the excuses and the things that he had been telling us. But they ultimately sentenced him to 7 years in prison. He had to register as a sex offender. He was to be on supervised release for life. The court had asked for him to be sent to a specific prison because they apparently have a sex offender treatment program there. So he could have completed it while he was incarcerated. They didn't send him there. Then that began a whole different stage in this journey. The kids, we were still working with the play therapist to kind of help prepare them for that as best we could and to say goodbye. After he was sentenced, he had some weeks before he reported to prison initially in Texas. It seemed odd to me that his parents, nor his brother and sister-in-law, none of them came to see him or say goodbye to him in person before he reported. But his mom did send a card that was kind of telling. She wrote, "Dear Wyatt, as you go, do not look behind you at what you have lost. Rather, look at what you still have. The love and support of your family and the love of your children, your education, and many years of carefree living prior to committing to marriage and children. That in itself should carry you through the next years and behind. Go with peace and confidence. Hugs and kisses, Mom." It was my family that ended up flying with him to Texas. One of my brothers did, and then drove him to the prison to report. I think they wanted to be there for me, and they were going to certainly support the children. After he had reported to prison in Texas, I made good on my promise that I needed to see all of the documents in his legal file. So I asked him to essentially give consent to his lawyers to release that to me in its entirety, which he did. He sent them a letter. Their office let me know when those were ready. I received not only the legal files that the defense team had, but also a copy of that handwritten letter with his permission that I have a copy of them. That means I received all of that documentation legally and with his consent, even though the court documents are sealed from the public. I went and picked up a big, massive stack of papers, hoping that would fill in the details of this investigation so that I could either confirm what he had been telling me all of this time and make a determination on whether my kids were safe for him to parent. There was a lot. Firstly, it was certainly not a mistake or an error unless you can legitimately make a mistake almost 5,000 times. So he had a tremendous amount of child sexual abuse material. And that was just what they discovered when they raided our home. The age ranges of the children that were being victimized in these photos and videos ranged in age from, I believe, as young as 6 or 8 to 12, 15. And then I found in a psych evaluation that his defense team had requested during that pretrial period. He, it sounds like, pretty openly spoke to this person about having taken images and videos of me and then having disseminated those, not just posting, but trading these images and videos of me online and on the dark web directly with other strangers for a very long time. Had no idea that he was doing this. He even adjusted his behavior to become more surreptitious. So that was a tremendous shock for me. I did reach out to the United States District Attorney for a few reasons. I asked him, am I identifiable? Can you see my face? Does he identify who I am or say who I am? Is there like a geotag or location in any of these? Am I safe? I don't know where these went, who has them, how many there are, what the content is. I did tell him that I did not want to see them, but I was concerned from a safety standpoint. I also realized through those conversations with the USDA, the internet has really boomed and technology has boomed. And unfortunately, our laws have not been able to keep up. We didn't have a law at that time, which, thank goodness, we're beginning to fine-tune those and have some on the books in many states for, I think, what they're calling revenge porn laws. There's a really short statute of limitations that's attached to that. I'm grateful that we have something, but the statute of limitations makes it difficult. And in my situation, that made it difficult for me to really seek any kind of justice. The USDA also said he's already in federal prison, serving a much bigger sentence. If you were to try and pursue this, it would probably be a really brief sentence. So he said what you would have to go through and what the children may have to go through for me to try and seek justice for what he had done to me, we were going to be sacrificing a lot to gain a little. So at the time, I didn't move forward with that. After receiving the information from his legal file, I then went to Texas by myself without the kids so that I could confront him face to face, let him know that I knew these things, that I knew he had not been honest about it, that I realized how sick he was, and that our marriage was over. My concern was that he was willing to use me and my images and videos, which that was obviously a tremendous violation, but then to disseminate them, and he even says he traded them like baseball cards to get some of the materials that he really wanted. So what would keep him from surreptitiously capturing pictures of my children? Even if he's not directly interested in that, he knows others are. There was no fixing this. I did file for divorce not too long after. I was a little anxious about losing control over keeping my kids safe. Once I filed for divorce, although I thought that because he had been convicted of crimes against children, that that would give me the ability to protect my children, I was surprised to find that I was told his right to parent was kind of largely not going to be affected.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I was getting my son ready for school, and all of a sudden, we heard knocking at the front door and also knocking at the back doors. We kind of held each other for a minute, a little scared. It did feel like being thrown right back into that initial raid. Here is law enforcement again on every side of my house. It was the United States Marshals looking for Wyatt.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media.
Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.